Ante todo, quiero agradecer a todos los asistentes, a Cindy Sheehan, por haber aceptado nuestra invitación, y al Comité de Chicago para la liberación de los cinco cubanos, por la iniciativa de organizar el tour, especialmente a Stan Smith, que es el organizador de todo el tour. Cindy Sheehan, madre de cuatro y abuela de tres, una mujer,
Cuatro ya,
cuatro,
cuatro ahora, sí.
y abuela de cuatro, una mujer ordinaria que la dinámica belicista hizo que perdiera a su hijo Casey Austin. Luego de eso se ha convertido en un torbellino que cuestiona no la causa superficial, sino el modelo que permite que los señores y transnacionales de la guerra se adueñen del mundo mientras mueren miles de inocentes. No hay momento más oportuno para esta conversación. Afganistán, Libia, Siria, la conferencia en Naciones Unidas, la liberación de los dos alpinistas en Irán, la solicitud de reconocimiento del Estado de Palestina ante las Naciones Unidas. Solo quiero culminar tomando parte del mensaje de nuestro presidente Hugo Chávez, leído el día de ayer por nuestro canciller en las Naciones Unidas. Solo el costo de 3 semanas de bombardeos de la OTAN sobre Libia permitiría atender las necesidades inmediatas las necesidades inmediatas de los millones afectados por la hambruna en el Cuerno de África, cuyos costos ascenderían, según los expertos, a 1.400 millones de dólares. Sin más preámbulos, le cedo la palabra a Cindy Sheehan. First of all, I want to thank all of you for being here. I want to thank Cindy Sheehan for accepting our invitation to be here. And especially want to thank the Chicago Committee to Free the Cuban Five, especially Stan Phil Smith, which is the organizer. Cindy Sheehan, a mother of four, a grandmother of four now, a very ordinary woman, which the war machine make her somehow allow her to become a thunder because of the death of her son, Casey Austin. After that, she has been starting a massive campaign against the war, and she has become a very recognized worldwide activist against the war. And she having attacked the superficial causes of the problem. She has been going too deep inside into the causes of the problem that allows the transnationals and the warlords to control and generate the deaths of millions of innocent people. This is a very timing, a very good time. This event is organized in a very good timing because of Afghanistan, because of Libya, because of what happened in Syria, because the recent conference summit in the United Nations, because of the liberation of the two hikers by the Iranian government, because of the request of for the Palestinian to be recognized as a sovereign state. So we believe that this event is happening in the perfect time, and I just wanna add part of the speech of our Ministry of Foreign Affairs yesterday in the United Nations that says that only 3 weeks of bombing, of OTAN bombings over Libya, might help solve the problems of hunger in the Horn of Africa, which is estimated in $1.4 billion. So without more presentations, I welcome Cindy Sheehan.
Thank you, Jesus. It's just a pleasure and an honor to be here. I got here early Monday morning here to Chicago, and hit the ground running with an early event that morning. I've been to DePaul, Northeastern, Illinois University, the Hull House, Dominican University, and I just got finished at Loyola University. So it was a really packed schedule, but it was just so amazing to me that especially at Dominican yesterday, where I was explained that a lot of the students are immigrant, they're lower socioeconomic, diverse, a diverse student body. You know, not like the other schools I spoke at. I didn't really like witness that much diversity as I did yesterday at Dominican. And for the students to come up to me and say, "You really inspired us," or "You inspired me." And so many of them, I just left floating on air. So this is a great, it's been a great week. Because I think that people are sensing that something's wrong, but they don't really exactly know how to identify it. They don't know how to put their finger on what the problem is. And not only do they not know how to put their finger on the problem, but the propaganda they see is telling them something different. So there's like a, there's like, they're like having these disconnects. It's like, wow, if the economy is improving, then why is my economy not improving? You know, if so many different things we're being told by our media and people are having different experiences. So yesterday, even at Dominican, some of the students, the teacher said, "You go, you know, this is our class. You have to go. It's the class." So I told the kids, "Sorry, you're forced to be here. I'll try to make it not so awful for you." And they wanted to go back to their class after the speech and say, "Let's talk about how we can implement what Cindy said. Let's talk about strategies to go forward," because it was just so very exciting for them to hear that, yes, we have a problem, but yes, there are solutions, and they don't necessarily exist in the establishment, in the mainstream, that people do have power. And one of the things that I've been talking to the students about, and others, I see people who have been at the speeches and other places here also, is that, you know, just because the United States has been doing these things this way forever, doesn't mean we have to keep going forward the same way. And I'm writing a book right now called Revolution, A Love Story. And did anybody watch Michael Moore's Capitalism, A Love Story? Okay, so it's kind of like making fun of Michael's title, but also going further than he did. It was pretty good. It was good to get this conversation in the mainstream, right? How capitalism is destructive. But Michael didn't get, one of Michael's solutions was not socialism. It seemed like his solution was more capitalism. You know, if we can reform capitalism and make it healthy, then it'll work for us. So let me tell you my story about Venezuela. And when I first went to Crawford, Texas in 2005, after my son was killed, I was very new in the movement. Casey had been gone only a little over a year. And I just started a few weeks after he was killed. I started researching. I started traveling. I thought before Casey was killed that one person couldn't make a difference, that my voice would be insignificant. And that's what we're taught. You know, we're taught that, you know, that, I don't know if so much they like come out and really say this, you know, but we're taught that the solutions only exist in this country in the two-party system, political solutions. You know, we have to, if we could only, you know, vote for Barack Obama or vote for Ron Paul or vote for whomever, that's all we have to do and our problems will be solved. And that grassroots movement energy is not significant. And so anyway, after my son was killed, I thought, well, at least I'm going to try. If I can't make a difference, at least I'm going to try. And so I started traveling and speaking against the lies of the Bush administration. At that point, in 2004, 2005, there was still an overwhelming support of George Bush and support of the wars, and not really a lot of public questioning of the wars. And anybody who questioned it, even mildly, you know, they were people like Phil Donahue, who was fired from MSNBC for questioning. And, you know, so even mild criticism was demonized, ostracized, and certainly not encouraged. So me being who I am, I don't care. You know, I don't care that if what I have to say is unpopular, because sometimes popular things are not right, and oftentimes popular things are not right, and unpopular things are right. And I've seen it just in my own activism. In 2004, 2005, I was not mainstream, but eventually most of the rest of the in this country, you know, outside of the United States, the wars were not popular, but in the United States they were. And so people caught up. You know, oftentimes I felt myself way out in front of everybody, but people catch up. The problem with this country is that at least in the last 7 years since my son was killed, we haven't been able to translate polling numbers or popular sentiment into policy. And so then, you all know, I went to Crawford, Texas in the summer of 2005, and that's when ordinary Americans knew that there was anti-war and anti-Bush sentiment in this country. You know, people who listen to, you know, alternative media, who read the internet, who read progressive alternative sites on the internet knew. But most Americans, that's not where they get their news. Most Americans get their news from CIANN. Most Americans get their news from faux news. And so, or Pentagon Broadcasting System, or National Pentagon Radio. And so people get their news from mainstream corporate propaganda sources. And so when I went out to Texas, for some reason those sources covered our protest, until they realized that, oh, it's just not her. It's just not some crazy mother, some crazy grieving mother. It's millions of people who, because there was this big Cindy Sheehan Speaks for Me movement. There were vigils all over the world in support of the people who actually were able to go to Crawford, Texas. And so then the media had to shut it down, shut their coverage down, or change their coverage into demonization of the movement or of me. And that's why I resisted being called the leader of the movement, because if you demonize the leader, then the entire movement gets painted with that brush and things like that. It didn't work because, let's face it, I was a soccer mom from Vacaville, California, who was a Catholic youth minister for 8 years before I went to Crawford, Texas. What dirt are they going to find in my closet? You know, so they actually, and I'm actually, you know, a very spotless housekeeper. So they weren't going to find any dirt in my closet. And so anyway, my kids call that anal. I don't know. I just like it that way. And so anyway, in the beginning of 2006, there was the World Social Forum in Caracas. Did any of you go to the World Social Forum in Caracas, Venezuela? Well, I was invited to the Social Forum, and I went. And at that time, I was so busy and being new to the movement. From the summer of Camp Casey until that time, I traveled outside of the country. I was I was just inside the country, just very busy with, you know, speaking engagements, rallies, interviews. Crazy, just crazy, busier than this week, you know, this past week has been. And so I went to the World Social Forum, and I knew about President Hugo Chavez. I knew that he was an outspoken critic of the United States empire and of George Bush. What did he used to call him? Senor Peligro? Mr. Danger? And, you know, he went to the UN and said, oh, the devil must have been here. I smell sulfur and stuff like that. And so, you know, I knew that he was an outspoken critic of U.S. foreign policy. And so I knew that I liked him, and I knew that he was admired a lot by the left in the United States. And that's about all I really knew. And I thought the World Social Forum was like some place that we get together and socialize. You know, it's like, oh, everybody, all these activists from the world are going to get together, and it's going to be like this social event. And I didn't know it was about socialism. But a better world's possible. That's the theme. But that's what I was working for. I'm working for this better world. And so I went to the U.S. Social Forum, I mean, the World Social Forum. I was very busy there also. You know, as soon as I woke up the morning I got there, the hotel switchboard kept on forwarding me all these interview requests, all these people that wanted to meet with me, and blah, blah, blah. So I was in a meeting, and somebody came and told me that the president wanted to meet with me. And so he took me and some of my comrades to Miraflores to meet with President Chavez. I already met him, but we didn't have a chance to chat or whatever. And so I got back from Venezuela, and all of a sudden, I got all these attacks, not just from the right. I got these attacks from the so-called left, you know, saying I shouldn't meet with anti-American communist dictator Hugo Chavez, and just because he's the enemy of your enemy, it doesn't make him your friend, and all this stuff. But when I met with President Chavez, I met somebody who is very intelligent, very gifted, very compassionate, a people's person. I had met all the politicians in the United States. When you meet politicians in the United States, you meet their mask, you know? You don't meet that person. You meet the person that their PR people tell them to be. You know, you meet the facade. You don't meet a genuine person. But when I met President Chavez, I met a genuine person. And so I not only liked what I heard about him, I actually liked him. But I thought, wow, maybe I better do some more research. If I'm going to support somebody, maybe I better actually research more carefully. And guess what? My research confirmed my support of President Chavez and the Bolivarian Revolution and Venezuela. And so anyway, I have a couple of stories to tell. This is a humorous story that happened to me in Venezuela. I was at the World Social Forum. I was like the star of the forum. And so they invited me to speak at this huge rally. There was tens of thousands of people there. Now, rallies that are in Latin America, they're so energetic, and they're so colorful, and they're so, like, you know, people dancing, and they have all these colorful banners and things they carry and musical instruments and everything. And so it was really fun. And I get up to speak, and at my translator is Cuban. And so I'm giving my speech, and people are cheering, they like it. And at the end of my speech, I want to like reassure them that I'm not the only one in the United States who feels the way I feel. And so I said, you know, for me, there's millions of people in the United States who feel the same way. And my translator translated it, people cheered. And I said, and there are people, myself and people like me, who are working to hold the Bush administration accountable. And my translator translated it, and everybody cheered. And then I said, and we're working really hard to have him impeached. My translator, everybody cheered. And then I said, and impeachment's not enough. We want him in prison. And my translator translated that. They went nuts. Viva Cindy! You know, just like crazy. I'm like, wow, I really kicked ass. They love me. And I'm going back home, and I'm in Miami going through immigration. And this woman came, ran up to me. She goes, Cindy, hi. And I'm like, and she was American. I'm like, hi. She goes, I was at the World Social Forum. I said, yeah, me too. Wasn't it great? And she goes, yeah, I was at your speech in the big rally. I said, yeah, they loved me. And she goes, you're right, but let me tell you why. And I said, why? She goes, well, I'm fluent in Spanish. I'm like, okay, that's nice. What does that have to do with anything? And she said, well, when you said impeach, your translator said impeach. When you said hold accountable, that's what your translator said. But when you said put him in prison, your translator said execute him. And so I hadn't gone through immigration yet. And I was like, geez, they're not going to let me back in the country. You know, but they let me back in the country, and it was in Miami, and they don't like me in Miami. They don't like President Chavez in Miami. They don't like the Cuban Revolution in Miami, of course. But then I got to think, you know what? Execution, capital punishment is legal in this country. Even if I did advocate it, unfortunately, I wasn't advocating anything that is extra legal or extrajudicial like our country does. So, and then that was one story I have about Venezuela. That was a funny story. And I told you I was going to tell you two stories about Venezuela. And I can't remember. Oh, okay. I think I told this one at DePaul, if you were at DePaul. But so I told you I became a defender of Hugo Chavez and the Bolivarian Revolution, but in a more educated way, not just a feeling way. I did research. And so, of course, that opened me for a right-wing attacks, left-wing attacks. And I got invited to go on MSNBC with it was a show called Hardball with Chris Matthews. Do you know, you guys know that show? And so anyway, usually when I go on these shows, I don't go face-to-face with the interviewers. Usually I am doing it remotely, but this time they invited me into the studio because it was in Washington, D.C. So I get to the studio, and it's not Chris. I've met Chris before. I've been on his show before. Definitely not Chris because it was a woman. And it was a woman. She said, Cindy, I'm Nora O'Donnell. She said, you know, we play hardball here. And I was like, whatever. Yeah, bring it on. And so at first, the funny thing is I thought she was a correspondent named Kelly O'Donnell. And Kelly O'Donnell, they both have red hair. They're both named O'Donnell. And so Kelly was chubby and Nora was really skinny. And so I told her, wow, Kelly, you've lost a lot of weight. And she goes, what? She's like, what are you talking about? And I said, well, when you were in Crawford, you weighed a lot more. She goes, I've never been to Crawford. And I said, yeah, you did. You interviewed me there. She goes, I know. I've never been to Crawford. You must be talking about Kelly. I'm like, well, who are you? She goes, I'm Nora. I'm like, oh, okay, sorry, Kelly. And so anyway, she introduces me. I sit down. I was the first guest. She introduces me as a woman who met with communist dictator Hugo Chavez. So we went to a pretend break because it was being taped. And I said, Kelly, you know that Hugo Chavez is not a communist. He's not a dictator. And I went on to explain why he wasn't, how he survived so many elections and a coup attempt and, you know, a recall attempt, all financed by the United States. The opposition, even in elections, financed by the United States. Our dear friend Eva Golinger has shown that the United States has funneled like $100 million to the opposition since Chavez has been president through the National Endowment for Democracy, through USAID, through other NGOs. And that's not legal here in the United States, by the way. I ran for Congress. Foreigners can't contribute to political campaigns. But, you know, apparently the United States thinks it's okay to contravene, you know, sovereignty and donate to the opposition in Venezuela. And so anyway, I was explaining some things to Nora, Kelly, whatever her name was. And she said, oh, we know all that. We had a meeting this morning and we decided to call him a communist dictator anyway. See? So not only does the news lie to you, they know they're lying to you, but they have meetings to figure out how to lie to you. So people who are casual consumers of the news, they hear Chavez, communist dictator. That's what they believe, right? They heard it on the news. That must be the truth. So the rest of the show, I wasn't there to talk about Venezuela or Chavez. I was there to talk about something else. The rest of my interview, I spent defending Hugo Chavez, telling people that's what she said, that they want you to believe he's a communist dictator, whatever. And at the end of the interview, she said, Cindy, she's such Cindy, would you rather have Hugo Chavez as your president than George Bush? I was like, what is this, a trick question? Yeah, of course I would. Duh. And the next day, you would think there was nothing else happening in the world because all the commentators were talking about, you know, how I said that I'd rather have a communist dictator as my president than George Bush and blah, 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 whatever. So those are just my mainstream American experiences. Do you all know who Arianna Huffington is of the Huffington Post? She just sold her Huffington Post to AOL for, what, $315 million or something like that? And after I went to Venezuela the first time and met with Chavez, I was literally summoned to her mansion. And she told me that, you know, she raked me over the coals for meeting with Chavez. Yeah, and here, you know, she just, her Huffington Post used to be kind of like radical. Now it's all this celebrity, Michael Jackson, you know, whatever's the newest thing we're supposed to care about. She fosters that. You know, all these distractions when really important things are happening in the world. And we get all these distractions. We're supposed to care about a trial down in Florida of a mom who may have murdered her daughter, which is a terrible crime. It's a horrible situation. It's tragic. But we don't talk about the thousands of babies being murdered by the U.S. wars for empire. Or we don't talk about the economic terrorism that neoliberalism is causing all over the world. You know, some people existing on $2, $3, $4 a day, right? We're supposed to care about these flashy show trials or whatever. That Casey Anthony trial, was it in Florida? People lined up starting like at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning to get a seat in that trial. It looked like when they opened the courtroom doors, it looked like the day after Thanksgiving at Walmart. You know? And everybody's like running in and trampling each other. you know, so they can buy this plastic consumer crap, you know. So anyway, yeah. So I'm researching my book, Revolution, A Love Story. I'm researching, since I went to Venezuela the first time, researching the Bolivarian Revolution, researching other movements that have been inspired by the Bolivarian Revolution, researching how there's many leaders in Latin America who want to join in solidarity, or even in an institutional way, to create healthy alliances that resist the crimes of the empire to the north. You know, the organization they're creating that is in opposition to the Organization of American States that excludes Canada and, you know, the United States of America, to have these healthy alliances to help their economies, help their ecologies, help their societies in a way that is not controlled by the United States of America. And so I think that is very exciting. I think what's happening in Latin America is like one of the most exciting places to be in the world right now, because it's not even though President Chavez is president of Venezuela, even though he is a revolutionary leader, it's not a top-down situation. So I wanted to go back to Venezuela with my new knowledge, you know, with more research under my belt, and go into the neighborhoods and talk to regular Venezuelans, whatever that means. You know, I've been described twice as ordinary today, and I don't know what that means, but I don't think I've ever really been ordinary. Ask my kids. They always say, Mom, you're super not ordinary. You're a weird mom. So anyway, whatever an ordinary Venezuelan normal citizen was, that's who I wanted to see. That's who I wanted to talk to. And so I got an opportunity to do that. Also, you know, I also got the opportunity to interview President Chavez for my book. It was a documentary, now it's a book. That's a long story. And I got to interview some other officials in the Venezuelan government. But I also got to interview these, you know, whatever, ordinary Venezuelans. But they're not ordinary. They're extraordinary. They're extraordinary people. People who were, you know, 5 or 10 years ago illiterate. They didn't know how to read. They needed, you know, dental work that they received. That gives you more confidence. You know, people don't think what bad teeth, you know, or whatever. They don't think that sometimes is a barrier to people in communication, right? But to be able to access dental care, education, health care, community organizing in a real grassroots way, it prefers human dignity. And that's what's so lacking here in our marginalized populations, is human dignity, you know? So that's how I talked to these people. This lady just gave me the biggest smile. You know, she's like, 2 years ago, I wouldn't have smiled because I didn't have any teeth. You know, and she's beautiful and standing up straight and so proud of her teeth. I've never met anyone in America who said, look at my teeth, aren't they awesome? You know, isn't that great, a big smile or whatever? No, we say, look at my new car, isn't that awesome? You know, look at my new TV. Look, I got a new phone or whatever. That's what we focus on. But, and so I talked to these super extraordinary people in Venezuela who most of all were illiterate not too long ago, who are taking power, taking responsibility and power for their own lives. So the Bolivarian Revolution and their charismatic, caring president has empowered people. Here in the United States, we are disempowered. We are disenfranchised. You know, we have our human dignity taken away from us. And it's the opposite in Venezuela. You know, recently in Bolivia, because I did have a chance to meet with President Morales the last time, well, 2 times ago when I was in Venezuela. Actually, I met with him in Uruguay. But anyway, there's this highway being built through the indigenous areas. And there's some problems with it. The indigenous people have legitimate concerns. But what did President Morales do? He said, let's stop it. Let's put it on hold. Let's have a national dialogue. Because people were protesting and there was opposition to it. I can't remember that ever happening in the United States. You know, where we opposed something our government was doing and the president said, well, let's have a national dialogue. Now, Barack Obama promised us that would happen, right? Or did I just dream this? Now, didn't he say during his campaign that if there's a bill that Congress is considering, that they would put it on a website and we would be able to read it and we would be able to give our feedback? Didn't he say that? Okay, good. Yay! I wasn't just imagining things. Because, you know, you don't have to imagine anything bad because sometimes I don't think, how can people even imagine what's happening in this country? I've never had any hope in Barack Obama. But I didn't, myself, didn't think it was going to be this bad. He has exceeded my low expectations of him. He really has. And so I'm frankly shocked that way. People say, aren't you disappointed? Well, I didn't have any expectations, so I can't be disappointed. But frankly, I'm a little shocked at how fast he's been bad. And so anyway, I want the people in the United States to feel this empowerment. But it's not coming from the top down. It has to come from the bottom up. We have to reach within ourselves and feel that same empowerment that some of the people in Latin America are feeling. And we're not, the ruling class does say stuff like, oh, it's your country, you know, we're for the people, by the people, whatever. But our reality doesn't match the rhetoric ever. And Barack Obama did say, well, if you want me to do anything, you're going to have to make me do it. You know, there's going to have to be social movements behind me to make me do it. And so after he was elected, I tried to tell the people in the social movements, well, let's go. Let's do it. You know, let's create the political space for him. Let's give him some courage. Let's get out in the streets. And you know what I was told? We got to give him a chance. You know, Cindy, just give him a chance. Well, 3 days after he was president, he ordered the first drone bombing in Pakistan that killed 36 people. And at that point, I said, what do you want to give him a chance for? More killing? More drone bombing? And look what's happened. You know, we're in a big way in Libya, Somalia, Yemen. He's increased hostility to Pakistan, increased troop strength to Afghanistan, and we're still not out of Iraq. And so giving him a chance has been very harmful. And not only are these tensions increasing around the world, you know, now I heard today that they're considering sanctions against Syria, a no-fly zone. No-fly zone is code for we're going to be bombing you soon, yep. Right? And that's what I wrote when they put the no-fly zone in Libya. I sent it out to my list of supporters, and my list of supporters got a lot shorter that day. You know, unsubscribe. I was like, what? You know? And people were emailing me going, Cindy, you don't care about the people of Libya. And I'm like, well, I absolutely do. That's why I don't want them to be bombed. You know, I care so much about them. I don't want innocent Libyans being killed. You know, and this some man got up today at Loyola, and he said, you're against, you know, an international use of force to save people's lives. I said, I'm always against it. I'm always against it because it somehow doesn't turn out that it saves people's lives. You know, this is the 21st century, and we're still talking about militarism and force and bombing to solve problems. And most of the time, the problems that our empire sets out to solve are either greatly exaggerated or completely made up. So we're using this extraordinary force to solve problems that usually don't even exist. Because if those problems didn't exist, certain people in our country and global international corporations wouldn't be able to profit. So if there's not a problem, you have to make one up. And that's literally what's happening all over the world. So what kind of country is this where somebody that stands up and says, there is a nonviolent solution to these problems. Is that person is the one who is a social outcast and a pariah. Not the person who says, well, you know, we're just going to have to bomb them. You know, these people go around the world threatening economic sanctions. Economic sanctions are an act of war. You know, they're very hostile rhetoric. Hillary Clinton, you know, Barack Obama, all these people who are supposed to represent. Hillary Clinton's in the State Department. She's supposed to be going around doing diplomacy, you know, not hostility. And so, but somebody who stands up and says violence is not necessary is the person who has a problem in our society. And so people say, well, you know, Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, communist dictator, blah, blah, blah. I went and I asked the deputy foreign minister, I knew the answer to these questions already. I said, so how many countries has Venezuela invaded lately? Zero. How many countries is Venezuela occupying besides Venezuela currently? Zero. How many countries have you guys bombed in the last few years? Zero. Yet, Hugo Chavez is dangerous, right? How many countries has Iran invaded recently? Zero. 500 years, I understand. It's been 500 years since Iran's been the aggressor. Of course, they had the war with Iraq, but from what I understand, Iran wasn't the aggressor in that war. So whenever the U.S. empire starts to demonize a world leader or a country, I immediately start my research and know that if the empire, whatever the empire is saying, 180 degrees away from that is probably the truth. So I start with the premise that our government lies 100% of the time. And, you know, once in a while, but not very often, I find that our government tells the truth. You know, usually my suspicions are confirmed. Unfortunately, I wish they weren't. I wish that they weren't confirmed. So, part of my book, Revolution, a Love Story, is not just identifying the myths that surround President Chavez and the Bolivarian Revolution and the amazing struggles against neoliberalism that are happening all over Latin America, but to tell people in the United States that we can do the same thing here. You know, that it's possible, that we can reject this system that cares more about human greed than human needs. You know, to tell people, you know, human rights are the same here as they are in Venezuela. You know, we have the right to health care. We have the human right to education, to housing, to a job. You know, these are human rights. They're not privileges for the oligarchy. Now, I read from the Miami Herald today, and of course, I can't believe anything the Miami Herald says, especially if they're talking about Cuba or Venezuela or Fidel or Castro. Oh, wait, that is Castro. Or Chavez. It's been a long week. That President Chavez's health has taken a turn for the worse. So we know that he is ill. And however, we also know, first of all, we need to send all our healing energies and good wishes. And if you pray, you know, whatever your tradition is, that needs to be sent to President Chavez for his health. But people always ask me, what's going to happen to Venezuela if he dies? Well, and I ask that to people in Venezuela. I said, you know, Chavez can't be president for life. But everybody I talk to rejects that. Oh, we want him to be president forever. And, you know, eventually, just like all of us, he's going to die. You know, I hope, viva, long live Chavez, long live the revolution, long live, you know, Fidel, long live the revolution. But just long live. It's not like, they're not, what's that word? Immortal, right? But being in Venezuela and talking to those people, they've gone from not being able to be educated to be educated. They've gone from no health care to health care, no dental to dental, no house to, you know, whatever. They know. They've gone from not having dignity to having dignity. They've gone from being disempowered to being empowered. And it might have taken a charismatic leader to move that revolution forward. It might have taken an extraordinary human being like Chavez to move that forward. But those people aren't gonna give back their gains. They're not just gonna let the opposition take power and take everything back away from them. You know, no, they've seen a better way. They know a better way. They're not going back. So although we wish long health and life to these leaders, I'm also confident that the revolution will continue long past Chavez. And revolution is a process. You know, Venezuela is not perfect. Cuba is not perfect. But every day they are striving for this perfection. Even though that also is not attainable, they're striving for it. And so my whole thing is there are a lot of institutional barriers here, but back before President Chavez was elected, nobody imagined that something like this could happen. Even he didn't imagine it. You know, he tried to overthrow the government in a military coup. That's the way he thought that that's the only way that power could be transferred in a way that would help the people. Here in the United States, we have a power transfer every 4 to 8 years. You know, it's the fraud of elections. People say, oh, we're using our military to spread freedom and democracy all over the planet. We don't even have democracy here. You know, people are like, the Ayatollahs choose the candidates in Iran that you get to vote, that the people of Iran get to vote for. Well, we have Ayatollahs here in the United States that choose our candidates. You know, the corporate media, Wall Street, the bankers, the military-industrial complex. The two-party candidates, the main party candidates, we don't choose them. They're chosen for us. You look at all of their campaign donors. The same people donate to both sides. Barack Obama got more money from Wall Street than McCain did. But McCain got money from Wall Street. You know, whoever wins, Wall Street wins and we lose. You know, my political organization that I work with, we say Wall Street has two parties. It's time we had one of our own. You know, and you can say that. The military-industrial complex has two parties. Big Pharma has two parties. You know, the prison-industrial complex, whatever corporation that profits off of people's misery, they have two parties. We don't have any. So they didn't think it was possible in Venezuela. Most of us in the United States, no matter, you know, how ill-informed we are not illiterate. You know, we do have, even though we have the widest income disparity of any first world nation, we do have a higher standard of living than most people on this planet. I think it's like essential, urgent, and a requirement and mandatory that we try to make the United States better, because that would make the rest of the world better. You know, I care about the people who are homeless here. I care about the people who are hungry. I care about the people who are jobless. I care about our young people who get sucked into the military because they can't afford to go to school or they can't find a job. I care about the people I live with, but I'm just, my compassion doesn't stop at the borders. My compassion exceeds the borders. And I think if we can take over our society and create a better one, if we can achieve close to peace and social justice, that's good for the entire planet. And if we have to do it one room at a time, then we do it that way. You know, it's hard to go up against, with an armed revolution against a country that has nukes, right? So we have to be very strategic and very organized in solidarity. And one thing that's very important is international solidarity movements. You know, we look at a place like Venezuela, not us, but most people, like, oh, it's a third world country. We can't learn anything from Venezuela. We can't learn anything from Bolivia. We can't learn anything from those communists down in Cuba. Today, Castro called Obama stupid. Did he see that? Because Obama said, oh, sure, I'll start to try and open up dialogue with Cuba if they change their society. They have to change their society first. And Castro was like, well, you know, if he talked about the Cuban Five. You know, this is a great society that imprisons heroes for no reason. If they look, why, maybe we'll start talking to them if they release the Cuban Five. You know, how arrogant to say, oh, they have to change their society. And the Cubans are like, hey, we like having education. We like having health care. You know, we like, who told us today, Stan, that Cuba has become the only country that has no child malnutrition now? That has reduced their childhood malnutrition to zero? We can't say that here in the United States. In the United States, 1 million children go to bed hungry every night. In Cuba, zero children go to bed hungry every night. And but Obama wants Cuba to change their society, and then he'll normalize relations with them. So I just think that it seems like here in the United States things are very hopeless. You know, that there's so much institutional momentum against true change. And people tell me, oh, but we get our rights taken away from us all the time, our human dignity. Only if we let them take these things away from us are they taken away from us. So I think that we should learn from international solidarity movements, from people in Japan who are really revitalizing their anti-nuke movement. We should learn from them to revitalize ours, you know, and there are many things that we can learn from many people that are involved in these struggles. And in the United States, the richest country in the world, we need to take a part. We need to be part of these struggles in a very big way, and not be so arrogant, so ignorant, and so such a closed-minded society to think that these struggles aren't... What's that noise?
The wind.
Oh, God. to join. Yeah, it really does. I'm from California. Nothing happens unless you count earthquakes. It's like, oh, is that weather? I'm not used to weather. So anyway, I think that's really all I have to say. Jesus, what do you want to do now? Where is Jesus? Okay. I think he said something about dialogue.
Yes, I read Gossips on Windows. I believe that we have the time right now to do a question and answer session. If you want to ask some questions to Cindy or to us, they're all open to receive those questions.
I have a question. How many people here are actually from Venezuela? Where's everybody else from?
Mexico.
Chile.
Colombia.
Chicago. Key West. Chicago. Where's that?
It was in the center of the evil empire.
Way to go with your mayor, guys.
No,
I want
to
say. Way to go.
Yeah.
Isn't he the one in the Obama administration who called people who criticize Obama from the left retards? He's such a nice guy. I have a great story about Rahm Emanuel. You want to hear it?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm 6 feet tall, right? Rahm Emanuel's he comes up to about here on me. But anyway, that's not the thing. In 2005... the Democrats, I met with all the Democrat leadership. They told me, Cindy, if you help us get control of Congress, we'll help you end the wars. And I was like, oh, that's a great deal. That sounds good. So I worked a lot, and the Democrats did take back control of Congress. 2007, they told me their agenda was going to be, you know, they had a 10-point agenda. Not one of... The things on that agenda was ending the wars. So that was already a bad sign. So we went to Washington, D.C. on the day that they were all sworn in, and Nancy Pelosi became Speaker of the House. And there was about 80 of us who went, and we made little, like, a copy of a placemat. Because remember Nancy Pelosi, I spend too much time with my grandchildren. Remember when Nancy Pelosi, do you remember when Nancy Pelosi kept on saying impeachment's off the table? And so we said, well, you know what? You might have your agenda, but the people who put you back in power, we have an agenda too. You know, we want the wars ended. We want George Bush and Dick Cheney impeached, blah, 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 blah. So we wrote this agenda, and we were going to pass it out to every congressperson. So we get into one of the bill. They wanted to take our papers away from us. They said, you can't bring these papers in. We're like, why? I was like, if it was a suitcase full of money, you would let us come in and pass it out. Why can't we hand these papers out? So we finally got an unsuspecting Democratic congressman to let us bring the papers in. He came up and he said, yes, you can let them bring their papers in. And we didn't even have a chance to pass them out because we heard that up in the Rotunda area that the Democrats were going to have a press conference and the Democrats were going to announce their agenda, their legislative agenda. So we thought, perfect. You know, they're going to announce their agenda. We'll just announce our agenda too. And you know what was the number one thing on their agenda that Rahm Emanuel was giving the press? This is like hilarious. Ethics. And so half of us went on one side of the press conference, half of us went on the other side. And we decided that if they started talking about ethics and not talking about peace, that we were going to start chanting. So we were going to chant something about end the occupation. Oh, investigate. Because even at that point, at the end of the year, George Bush had said, I'm going to do a surge. I'm going to escalate in Iraq. And that was one of the first things that the new Congress had to vote on. So our chant was de-escalate, investigate, troops home now. And I was on one side leading that half of the activists. And then David Swanson, some of you might know David Swanson, was on the other side leading that half of the activists. And we were going to have a signal. If the Democrats came out and started, you know, talking about ethics, we were going to do our chant. So the person who was the spokesperson for the Democrats was Rahm Emanuel. And he comes out and like the first things are, oh, and we're ethics and blah, blah, blah. And so David and I looked and we're like, so we start our chant. And what did Rahm Emanuel do? He turned around and walked away. He just like turned on his heels and ran. So the press are like, what are we going to do? So what did I do? I went up to the microphones and I announced our agenda, what we work so hard for. And so that's what got in the news that day, not the Democrats' ethics thing. What, F, that's so ridiculous. Who, do you even think you're fooling yourselves that you're going to have right, reform ethics in the United States? So it was amazing how he just like, he's like, oh my God, they're going to protest us too? What's up with that? We're the good guys, you know? And he just like took off. So he can be intimidated, by the way. Yes. That is a good one, isn't it? Yeah.